Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
I feel like if men went through the menopause, that's the only thing we'd ever be able to talk about.
It's so true. There'd be like conferences all the time.
There'd be like a show presented by Jeremy Clarkson where they like tried out different, I don't know, HRT or, you know, techniques to like make life easier for them.
Hello and welcome to Love Lives, a podcast from The Independent where I, Olivia Petter, speak to different guests every fortnight about the loves of their lives. Today, I am very excited to be joined by one of my favourite writers, the best-selling author, award-winning journalist, fellow podcaster, and I'm fairly reason one of the people who is part of the reason why I'm doing what I am doing here today. It's Bryony Gordon.
Oh, that's the nicest thing ever.
I have more. So having started in journalism as an intern at the Daily Express, Bryony has since achieved that rare feat of becoming a very famous journalist and penning several books, including The Wrong Knickers, Mad Girl, and now Mad Woman. So, welcome to Love Lives, Bryony.
Thank you for having me, Olivia. You're a very famous newspaper journalist.
No,
as well.
Don't be silly. I really do mean that because I remember reading The Wrong Knickers when it came out. I don't know, when, what year did that book come out?
It was like 800 years ago. It came out, no, do you know what? It came out in 10 years ago. 2014.
Yeah, so I read that when I was at university, and I think that was genuinely one of the things that made me feel like I want to go into journalism, which maybe is quite antithetical, actually, given what the book is about.
I hope your experience was less kind of like chaotic than
as I said that, I realised, I was like, maybe. But anyway, that's besides the point. It introduced me to your work.
Well, I'm glad you enjoyed it.
So the first question I want to ask you, because I know that this is how you used to start all of your episodes of the Mad World podcast, which you did for a while, is how are you really today?
How am I really? So I'm good. I'm very aware that I'm in sort of book promo cycles. Mm-hmm. So it's a bit like being on drugs. You know this, you know, like you're sort of running off, you're running off like coffee, not drugs anymore for me in my case, but that, and it's like I have to be quite careful that I don't sort of spiral and like lose sight of what's important, if that makes sense.
Yes.
So I'm good right now because the book seems to be doing well. But, and also just it's, you know, I guess because it's nice, you write about this stuff, you know what it's like, where you're kind of pouring your heart out onto the page and it's, you know, you're writing about quite dark stuff. Mm. And then it's good to know that it chimes with other people, I guess, and that, like this to me as well is like the best bit is like meeting the people that read the books because they're like, they're my tribe or I'm part of their tribe. I feel like each of the books, like even The Wrong Knickers, is me sort of saying, if you've been through this, don't worry, I have too and it's okay. And why don't we all hang around this little book together? Because it's better than being alone in our homes thinking we're freaks. That's kind of what each book I've written, I think, you know, has done. So The Wrong Knickers was like that chaotic period of my 20s where I was single and, you know, and, but also, yeah, just like clueless. Is it okay to swear?
Yes.
You know, and not very well, really, for a lot of it. But, and I wrote it when my daughter, like I literally wrote it on maternity leave. And I thought, oh, I'm through that now. My life is saved. Oh, well.
I want to come back to that because that's definitely one of the things I want to ask you about. But start us off by telling us about Mad Woman because it follows on from your 2016 book, Mad Girl, which was about OCD and your mental health. And so tell us the difference and the progression that has brought you from Mad Girl to Mad Woman.
So Mad Girl really, for me, it kind of changed my life and my career, certainly. So it's writing about this stuff. So I've had OCD since I was a little girl. And you know, really crippling. And my, we talk about everyone kind of goes, oh, I'm a bit OCD. You should see my sock drawer. And I was like, oh, it's always the sock drawer. My husband jokes, I wish you had the good type of OCD. Of course, there is no good type of OCD. But, you know, my OCD has always involved very dark, intrusive thoughts. So I always describe OCD as like your brain refusing to acknowledge what your eyes can see. So like that your hands are clean, or the oven is off, or the hair straighteners are off, or the bump in the road you've gone over is a speed bump and not a child. And it's the same with thoughts. So we all have thousands of thoughts every day. And, you know, we are not all of our thoughts. And we've all had that thought, you know, what if someone hands you their baby at a party? You're like, what if I just threw the baby on the floor? Or you're like on the tube and you're like, what if I just pushed, what if I just jumped in front of the tube? But most people, we go, oh no, that's obviously I'm not going to do that, you know, and we just miss it and we get on with our day. But with OCD, you become so distressed by the thoughts. You think that you ruminate on them to check you're not the thoughts. So basically, decades of my life were spent like checking that I wasn't a serial killing pedophile. You can see why people don't talk about that type of OCD, right? So I wrote about that. And I remember when I pitched the book and when I like did the breakdown, and I remember someone in publishing industry saying, you can't write about that. And I was like, no, but if I can't write that, I can't write this book.
Yeah.
And I'm glad I stood my ground on that, because it was like this visceral, like, shame, you know. But, and that, you know, that sent me, you know, it resonated with a lot of people and sent me into this world of mental health campaigning. I set up Mental Health Mates, which is, you know, a place for people to go for walks and talks together without fear of judgment. And I ran, you know, the London Marathon. I ran it 1 year in my underwear to show that exercise is for everyone. You know, like my whole life sort of changed because of it. But I've also learned a lot about myself. And in a way, I was quite naive when I wrote Mad Girl. Like, I definitely thought that mental health issues were like, oh, there's a chemical imbalance, just take a pill, you know, and there is an element of that. But I really realized during the pandemic, when I became very depressed, it was really weird, because I was like, it was the first time in my life I'd been depressed, and I looked around and I'm like, everyone else is depressed too. And that's totally appropriate. And I started to realize since Mad Girl that a lot of mental illness and mental health issues, they're really appropriate. They're like sophisticated ways of your brain telling you that something is not right in your life. And I, you know, a lot happened to me. I got sober after Mad Girl. But then in pandemic, I developed kind of binge eating disorder, and the OCD came back really badly. And I discovered that I was in early menopause, and there was so much I wanted to write about. But really what I wanted to say to people was, you know, I really realized, I was like, oh my God, I've never been mad. I've never been mad. Actually, you know, the subtitle of the book is How to Survive a World That kind of wants you to think you're the problem. And I realized I'm not a problem. Like, I want to say to women, you're not the problem, you're the solution, babes. And I think we're so gaslit as women, especially, into believing that we are the problem. And the more I learned about the link between hormones and mental health, also just living in a society that is not set up for us in any way still. I'm like, of course, so many of us have mental health issues. So, yeah, so that's what Mad Woman really is about. It's me saying, you're not mad, you're not a problem, you are the solution.
Yeah, and I also love the way that you have differentiated between the meaning of mad in Mad Girl and Mad Woman, because in Mad Woman you said, you know, Mad Girl was sort of about mental health, and Mad Woman is kind of more about mad in the sense of rage and
anger,
specifically female rage, which again is something that, you know, we are told to suppress and to withhold.
Yeah, yeah. And even in the, like, bringing this book out, I've had to stop myself from doing that thing of, like, apologizing. Like, oh, I'm sorry for promoting my book. And I'm like, why? Why am I sorry? This is something I've worked on. And, you know, I definitely, yeah, the need as well, because for me, I've realized what OCD is and was this kind of very, very extreme way of my brain making sure that I was good, that I was a good girl. Because if I could follow these rules and check these things, then I wouldn't be bad. And we know as women that being, you know, as a girl, being a bad girl is like, you know, like even Rihanna taking that on didn't change things that much. And, you know, for me, it was this obsession with being good. Like, I need to be good. And that ran through Mad Girl as well. Like, it was like my way of going, I'm not any of these things. I am a good person. And Mad Woman's a bit of me reclaiming it, going, actually, sometimes I am bad. Sometimes I am. And that is okay because I'm a human being. And I don't like the way we hold still women to different standards than we do men. So yeah, absolutely. That is the kind of the rage. But it's been so revelatory to me that realizing that it's okay to be bad, you know?
Yeah. And one of the things you quote in the book, which is something I always return to because I just find it so ridiculous and hilarious, is the word hysteria comes from the Greek word for womb.
Yeah.
And you talk about that. It's like, and your friend says, well, that makes sense.
Yeah. But also it's that thing of like hysterical my arse. Like, yeah. Like I always think, you know, it's so interesting with all the chat about menopause now, you know, and you can see there's starting to be a backlash about all the, you know, about the chat and from women as well. Women who, older women who've gone through it and go, well, it was fine for me. You're making a bit of a fuss about nothing. And I'm like, that's okay. Lucky you if you sailed through it and there were no problems. Brilliant. But like, can you accept that that's not the case for all women? And I was like, I feel like if men went through the menopause, that's the only thing we'd ever be able to talk about. You know?
It's so true. There'd be like conferences all the time.
There'd be like a show presented by Jeremy Clarkson mm-hmm. where they like tried out different, I don't know, HRT or, you know, techniques to like make life easier for them. Like I feel so acutely, this is still such a huge issue. And we like to think, oh, it's the year 2024, you know, we've gone forward. And I'm like, I mean, not enough.
No, definitely not enough. I mean, one of the things that you mentioned just then was the binge eating and how that developed in lockdown. And in one of the chapters, I'm going to quote, because you write it so brilliantly. You write, in the dark, I eat until there are threads of chorizo stuck in my teeth. And my throat is dry from all the salt in the jerky and I feel suitably sedated. Then I put the wrappers in a plastic bag and hide them down the back of the sofa. I am fine. Obviously, lockdown was an incredibly difficult time for everyone, as we've both mentioned. But at that time, what I found interesting about that was you were also writing about mental illness for another book, weren't you? You were writing about, No Such Thing as Normal and interviewing lots of medical experts. So talk to me about what it's like to write about issues like that while behind the scenes, you're going through something that you haven't quite registered yet, because it feels like it's something you touched on in Glorious Rock Bottom as well.
Yeah.
Which was your book about sobriety.
Yeah, it's really interesting. And that again is why I've written this book, because we have these notions, don't we? Like we love narratives, neat narratives, like beginnings, middles, ends. And that notion that like, I faced my demons, I triumphed over adversity, and then I went off into the sunset and lived happily ever after. And that, in my experience, is not what happens, you know. I didn't even, like you say, like without even registering that there was a problem. Like I, for a while, didn't realize it was a problem because I'd had bulimia in my 20s, but I hadn't purged, you know, since then. So I was like, I don't have a problem because I'm not purging. I'm binging at the moment. But it was like, there was still that sense because of kind of diet culture that was more of a moral failure than it was an eating disorder. And it was when I was interviewing people for this book, I was interviewing this eating disorders expert and she suddenly started talking about binge eating disorder. And I was like, oh my God, this is what's going on. And it was kind of a relief, but also like another thing. But then, you know, I'm not the first alcoholic to go into recovery and cross addict to food. Like this is the thing we talk about. There's a saying in like recovery communities, which is you deal with whatever's going to kill you first, you know? And for me, that absolutely was alcohol and cocaine. So when the pandemic came around, I was like 2.5 years sober and I was so relieved about that. But it was a weird time. I'm sure we'll be untangling the effects of lockdowns on mental health for like decades to come. And, you know, it was a kind of a coping mechanism. I couldn't sleep and I would just go and eat vast quantities, almost like in blackout. It was like drinking, you know, except it wasn't. And so, but I also realized, you know, when I really started to think about it and do the work, you know, do the work to kind of recover, get go into recovery from that, I realized that food, like, was probably my first, the first thing I ever kind of used to change the way I feel, you know. And we talk, like, food is incredibly powerful. I mean, it's a weapon of war. We see that now, you know. So, but it's also, it's the first way as children we ever learn we have power over our parents, right? So, like, we go, I'm not going to eat this broccoli, throw it on the floor. And it's like, oh, for the first time in my life, I can change, you know. And so it's incredibly kind of visceral and powerful. And, you know, and so I realized it was like, wow, this is as much a drug as cocaine or alcohol, you know. And it's, you know, it's all complicated. I kind of put my head above the parapet about it back in 20, when I realized what was going on. And I sort of got a lot of messages from women saying, I have this too. And I'm really ashamed because I put on so much weight. And there to me was like, it's, if you think of it as a weight issue, you're never going to get better. So we're kind of stuck in this, a lot of us, stuck in this sort of perpetual cycle of restricting and binging. So a lot of anorexics in recovery from anorexia develop binge eating disorder. And that's just simple biology. If you've been starving yourself, your brain is telling you to eat. You know, it's like it's a survival thing. So, you know, that diet culture where we live in is, it kind of encourage, it almost kind of feeds this, pardon the pun, feeds this behavior. And so the more I, and when I was writing this book, the more I thought about it and the more I looked into diet culture and how, you know, common it is and how it still is, you know, it just masks itself in different ways now. So now it's like blood sugar spikes.
Yeah, or, those things.
Yeah, or it's, you know, I saw a reel the other day, video, I sound like 800 years old. I saw a reel the other day of this woman, like, I don't count calories, I eat for my gut, right? And then she did this video of all the things she ate in a day. And I was like, you don't need to count calories because there are no calories in this, you know. And so gut health, while some people are very responsible, and there is, you know, obviously a very fascinating link between our gut microbiomes and our mental health and the rest of it, but it has been taken and co-opted and all of that stuff. So diet culture is so insidious. And
yeah, and it perpetuates this obsessive thinking. Because yeah, if you're if you're tracking your gut health, you're tracking your glucose, it's,
yeah,
you're constantly thinking about food and what you're eating. And like, I feel like, you know, a couple of years ago, it was the clean eating kind of yeah, phase. And I got so sucked into that. I remember spending hours watching YouTube videos about people talking about all the healthy things they were making. They would do these what I eat in a day videos,
yeah,
which, you know, ostensibly look really harmless and just joyful and cheerful. But actually, it's the same thing. It's like, it encourages that way of thinking where you're kind of constantly monitoring what you're eating and how it's affecting your body. And I really like the way you talk about weight in the book, because one of the things you say, and you kind of frame it as like a feminist issue, because you say that, you know, women are kind of encouraged to take up as little space as possible.
Yeah.
And, you know, so as not to threaten the patriarchy. And like, that's why the kind of conventional beauty ideals is like a small, frail woman, a fragile woman. And it's the same with age as well. And it reminds you of something that Naomi Wolf wrote about in The Beauty Myth, where she kind of talks about how, you know, we fetishize youth in women because an older woman is probably more autonomous, has more financial independence and more kind of more power and more confidence. And it's the same sort of thing, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. The kind of the weight thing is, yeah, it's like take up as little space as possible. And I think it's been really co-opted, you know, like I see it now. I really believe that I wouldn't eat anything, right? And then I was on cocaine. I was basically living off cocaine and Quavers, right? Until my sort of late 30s. And then obviously, when I started eating normally, I put on weight, and the kind of visceral reaction of certainly people, you know, below the line or whatever to that was really, they were like, you're a drain on NHS resources. And I was like, and I still get it. And I'm like, and, you know, but it was like, I was much healthier. And I had to be really careful when the binge eating disorder thing, and I was in treatment, was to not get attached to that shame about weight, because it isn't a weight issue, it's a soul issue, right? And I you know, I definitely think that there's always been like a size 18 woman in me desperate to get out, like the whole way through my kind of teens and 20s. And she got out in her late 30s. And I still kind of battle that misconception that, you know, because I'm bigger, I'm more unhealthy when I, you know, because I don't, yeah, it's so complicated. It just makes me feel so sad that so many women waste so much of their precious fucking energy obsessing about the way they look, because it's like doing the patriarchy's work for them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it literally is. And as you mentioned, so when lockdown happened, you were 2.5 years into sobriety.
Yeah.
That must have been incredibly difficult during lockdown obviously in lockdown, if you look at these stats, that was when a lot of people kind of veered into alcoholism mm-hmm. because they were just at home drinking. And you write about in the book how you had a kind of momentary relapse that wasn't really a relapse. But talk to us about that, because I'm interested in the thinking behind that and the way that that framed in your mind, and kind of it wasn't a relapse in the way you thought it was a relapse.
No. So 2022, January 2022, I became convinced that I'd relapsed because I'd taken some nightness when I had COVID, and I was, because it has like a smidgen of alcohol in it, and I was obsessed, and I was too scared to pick up a glass of water in case I accidentally had some gin or something like that. It was really obsessive, and I went to see my therapist, and he was like, "You have relapsed, but not on alcohol. You've relapsed on OCD." And I was like, "What?" And this was OCD. What OCD does is it also attaches to anything kind of precious in your life, because it's all about like you're going to lose that, you know. So sobriety was that precious thing, and I look back on it now, and it's kind of almost funny, you know. But it was really frightening.
But I think it really illuminates how little people know about OCD. Like you said earlier, like it is still so much the kind of sock drawer thing. And I hear people say it all the time, like, I'm so OCD. And I'm like, well, we've had all these conversations.
I know, so do I. And even talking about it makes me feel like, yeah. You know, it was 2 years ago, but it was like, I can feel the kind of OCD in my brain sort of wakes up and goes, but maybe, you know, like it's like such a, yeah, it was, I mean, it was, you know, it was delusional thinking, actually. It was delusional. It bared no reality to, bared no resemblance to reality. And my therapist said that to me, like, this is, and, but it was, I realized then that was when I realized the OCD was a lot about having to be good, yeah. And it was about perfection.
I think it's so important to keep talking about it, because I do think that there are so many people that are probably suffering with that without realizing.
Yeah.
And I do think that they're just losing their mind and in a very kind of undefined way.
Yeah.
But actually, like, it's you have this named known condition that you can get treated for and get help from. So I think it's so important to keep talking about it and the ways that it affects people. One of the things I really want to ask you about, because it struck out to me towards the end of the book, is progesterone.
Yeah.
Because I think I've written about contraception a lot before. And I think when I got the coil fitted a couple years ago, there was no mention this will affect your mood. There was like, it's such a tiny amount of hormones. Like, don't worry about it. It won't do anything. I swear to God, the coil made me very depressed.
Really?
Very cripplingly depressed. And it's only since looking into it as a journalist, and I spoke to lots of healthcare experts, and someone told me, well, some women are very sensitive to progesterone and it can affect your mood. And I just wanted to ask you about it, because I think there's one point in the book where you're terrified of thinking something has progesterone in it because of how it might affect you or.
Well, I couldn't. So basically, I realized that OCD episode, which was really bad. And a friend said to me, have you thought about it might be hormonal and you might be going through perimenopause? And I was like, what? And I got my hormones done, and it turned out that like The Rock has higher levels of estrogen than me. It's like really low. And I was absolutely perimenopausal. And anyway, so I went on HRT, the estrogen, and within 2 days, it was like, it was the difference between day and night. I was like, I was so much better. And then you have to take progesterone in the second half of the month, right? Okay. As part of HRT. And within 2 days, I was suicidal and weeping. And it was so noticeable. And I sort of called the doctor and she was like, okay, well, we'll try and get it into you in a different way that was less kind of so that you insert it vaginally. And same thing happened. And we kept trying different things. And she was like, you probably got progesterone intolerance. And we kind of added it all up. And I remember when I was pregnant, I was under the care of the local psychiatric team. And I remember as soon as I gave birth, it was like it lifted. And I remember my husband always saying that. It was like dealing with two different people. And it was so surprising because obviously we'd expected, God, she's gonna, maybe it's just going to get even worse. How is that possible? And of course, now it sort of tallies with the progesterone it leaves your body. It was sort of noticing, you know, and then they started talking to me about PMDD and I was like...
Yes, which is another thing I've just written about as well.
Yeah.
What makes me so mad? Why don't we know about this
stuff? I know, I know. And also because like for me, we didn't know about this stuff. So like my only medicine for it was alcohol and cocaine. You know, like I was like, I couldn't cope with, you know, life because it was, I always remember, there was always a point in my cycle where it was like, I went from being a vaguely sane human being to just, you know, quite a different one. And because I was drinking and drugging, it was so difficult to know what was what. And they said to me, well, listen, you have to have progesterone. And they were like, if the last option is the coil, and if that doesn't work, you'll have to have a hysterectomy. And that was like, what? And luckily, I think the coil did work for me. They said, weirdly, it does for a lot of progesterone. I mean, I don't, but I do definitely still feel it from time to time. And, you know, it's, again, yeah, it's like this thing that affects 1 in 20 women, but no one thinks about doing anything about it. Like, we're already just having conversations about endometriosis and all those other things that, you know, have plagued women since the dawn of time.
Oh, it just makes me so angry that this is what we have to deal with. It's like a long history of medical misogyny that just like stops people from researching it, funding it, and just dismisses women as crazy. And you just think how many women are dealing with suicidal ideation, like crippling depression, alcoholism, drug addiction, all of these things purely based on hormonal changes in their body that could so easily be fixed.
And I really think it made me physically unwell because I ended up, and only because I had a female doctor, I was like fainting from palpitations and I was just dismissed as it being, it's just hormonal. It's just stress and anxiety. Try losing weight. And I was like, oh, try doing some exercise. I'm like, I exercise all the time. And it was only, yeah, a woman took me seriously, referred me for an ECG. And while I was having the ECG, they were like, you're in atrial fibrillation. We need to send you to hospital. And there was these two female paramedics who were like, of course, you've never been taken seriously. You're a woman. And I felt so blessed to have those two women there because it made me, and you know, it's so interesting. So I got diagnosed with an arrhythmia and I was like, what's caused this? Am I to blame? The guy was like, no, you're not, to, you know, this is like a, it's like an electrical thing in your, you know, the chambers of your chest. And, but like, I swear to God, it was like a massive kick up the bum. It was like my body saying, are you going to like, you need to stop dismissing yourself. Like you're so depressed and you're so low and this has been so hard. Like just take some time, girl, baby girl. I was going to say baby girl, like, you know, and look after yourself. And I swear to God, I barely get it. Yeah. I barely get it anymore.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
I know you laugh at that, but you do have lots of fans.
I don't know really. There may be a new podcast in the works.
That's exciting.
And I am doing this crazy running challenge.
Great.
I'm running the Brighton Marathon. Uh-huh. And then I'm going to run from Brighton to Brighton to London over 2 weeks. And then I get to London, am I going to put my feet up, Olivia?
No.
I'm going to do the London Marathon. And this is to raise money for mental health, mates.
So that's two marathons in 2 weeks?
Yeah.
Wow.
And to show that exercise is for everyone.
That's amazing. And I mean, that brings us very neatly onto your first love that you've chosen for us, which is running, which you wrote a brilliant book about in 2018. And it's called Eat, Drink, Run. And there was one section at the beginning that really helped me. And basically, I think it was a few months before I read that book that I had gone through an abortion because of sexual assault.
I'm so sorry.
And it was horrific. And I've written about it before, talked about it before. But I read that book and there was something in the beginning that you said that I'm going to read. You said, you urge readers to keep an open mind and said, think not about what you aren't, but what you are. Remember that one day things could happen to you that you wouldn't be able to believe right now. The most astonishing, amazing things. Trust me when I say all you have to do is hold on. And it's such simple advice, like just to say, just hold on. But honestly, those are words that I still return to all the time when something feels really difficult and really painful. And I want to say thank you, first of all.
Thank you.
But I also want to ask you about how running came into your life and how it was so transformative to you. Because it is, like, it's so beneficial. It's like flushing the toilet in your brain.
Yeah. Well, I think also, you've got me a bit emotional now. And I'm so sorry that happened to you. I always thought exercise was like a punishment. It was like a form of punishment. And it was about making me smaller. And I hated it because I wasn't very good at it. Like, good at it. Like, I wasn't fast. I wasn't, you know, strong. I wasn't anything. I was always the last to be picked in PE. And then I remember being really unwell with OCD. And everyone was like, exercise helps. And I was like, oh, what do experts know? Like, I tried to find the exact combination of alcohol and drugs that would make my mental health better. And it only made it worse. And so I was like, I'm going to try running. And I remember going out one day, and I don't know how I even got myself out of the house. I was that light. And I remember like putting on, like, I didn't have running trainers. So I put on Converse, and then I had like a pair of my husband's tracksuit bums and a Star Wars t-shirt, like a normal bra. And then I remember leaving the house and being like, I'm gonna need water or I'm gonna die, and going back in, and all I could find was one of my daughter's like sippy cups. I mean, God knows what I look like, and it doesn't really matter, but I did feel better. And you know, and that just kind of carried on. And then I don't know, and then I signed up to do the London Marathon in 2017 when the official charity of the London Marathon was Heads Together, which is the mental health thing that the now Prince and Princess of Wales and Prince Harry had created. And they'd kind of got me involved. And I, you know, like, really was like the most insane year of my life, to be honest, because then I trained for the marathon. I definitely thought, I'm going to do this because this might stop me drinking. And I did stop drinking for like the duration of actually running the marathon, but it made me realize, I was like, shit, I've got a problem here. And yeah, so I did the marathon, and then I pretty soon after washed up in rehab. But running
was it very soon after the marathon?
Yeah, so the marathon was April 2017.
Yeah.
And I ended up in rehab in August. And because I think it showed me a different way of living as well. And it showed me exercise as like, a tool of nourishment and not punishment. So I like the thing I love about running is it doesn't matter how many times you have to go back to the beginning. Each time there's always that like sense of, oh my God, I can do, if I follow this plan, you know, and if you have mental health issues, you know, it's like structure is really important, right? So if I follow this plan to the letter, I will start to see that I'm able to do something I couldn't do the week before. And that's just so amazing for your self-esteem, you know? And I think the moment that you take out all of that, like about being the fastest or the thinnest or the fittest or whatever, it becomes really joyful. Like I run for the gains, not the losses. You know, I'm quite slow. And people always say to me, oh, what's your marathon time? And I'm like, what's your marathon time? And they're like, oh, I haven't done one. I was like, exactly, fuck off then, you know?
It's such a weird question.
I know, but people like, it's almost like they want you to prove that you've actually done it. And I love it. You know, on Saturday, I ran 17 miles, which was like hard, but I'm like, I love that I did that. And
do you listen to music while you run or podcasts?
I listen to a bit of everything. Yeah. Yeah. And yeah, because it's a long time.
Yeah.
On your feet, time. You need to.
Yeah, I've only ever done a half marathon once. And I remember podcasts because music, I just got bored of the same things all over and over again. Like, because when I listen to music when I run, I don't feel the same, but I dance in my head.
Yeah, I go into fantasy. I go into total fantasy. So I imagine, this is embarrassing, but I don't care. I imagine that I'm on Strictly and I'm in like musicals week. I've got to musicals week and like, this is actually, and Lin-Manuel Miranda's a guest judge and I'm dancing to Hamilton or In the Amazing. Heights. And I like literally, I'm high as a kite and like I get faster. I could do that for hours, hours, I tell you.
There is something about show tunes. I listen to a lot of Wicked soundtracks.
Yeah, 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 yeah. Oh yeah, no, I totally, Defying Gravity is like when you'll get like in the last 5K of like a 29K run, I'm like, we need to bring out the show tunes now.
So good.
Because there's nothing else for it. Like I am totally, and sometimes I sing along.
Yeah.
I run running with my friend who's also training me for this challenge, and I'm like, I ought to put the headphones on now, Vicky, and she just carries on, and she films me, and I'm just like booming out like Dear Evan Hansen, or you know, and then I kind of like it's between show tunes and Taylor Swift, and she's like, you look absolutely deranged, Briny. And I'm like, that's how I wouldn't have it any other way.
That's how you want it. Your second love is reading.
Yes.
When did you first discover that you loved reading? Was there one book that made you think, A, I love reading, or B, this is the book that makes me think I want to be a writer?
I think my first book, this is going to sound like a really weird one, was it not quite late on, so I was probably about 15, but it was Lord of the Flies.
Mm.
I always remember Stephen King said that that book was like the first book that had arms and they reached out and grabbed him. And I loved it. And I remember sitting it and just being, I love a bit of kind of like end of the world stuff. So I love a bit of Stephen King as well. But reading for me is like, it's like making sense of the world, but also escaping from it, you know? And definitely since I got sober, my evenings are spent now just reading and reading and reading and reading and reading and reading and reading. And I just love it. It's just a different, you know, it's probably a bit of an addiction, but much healthier one.
Yeah. And so do you favor kind of like crime thriller type?
I'm a bit like, if you looked at my like list, you'd probably think she's all right. So I love a bit of sci-fi, not like kind of space, but kind of apocalyptic. I just read this book called Inascension and it's just so beautiful, like really right sizing, you know, like it kind of, you know, it makes you see the vastness of the world and how lucky we are to be alive and all of that. I love, you know, I love that, but I love a bit of, you know, I've just read Kylie Reid's new novel. I love like a lot of modern, you know, contemporary stuff, but I also am like bang into like a bit of woo-woo.
Oh, I love woo-woo.
I love a bit of woo-woo, yeah. Like a bit of Louise Hay, completely bonkers. And, but also, you know, things like, you know, a bit of Brené Brown, a bit of like, Clarissa Pinkola Estes, The Women Who Run With the Wolves.
Oh, I haven't read that.
It's just the most magnificent book. It's all about us women, like, losing touch with, you know, we've lost touch with our kind of our feminine, you know, instincts. And she talks about how, you know, we remember that women, you know, apparently women used to be banished when they had their periods to, like, you know, and they would have to go and, you know, be alone because they were, like, dirty. And she said, I can just imagine every woman would, like, if we did that now, would turn, you know, leave the house going, and then get around the corner and go, yes! But it's such a good book. So I love a bit of woo as well.
Yeah, I love that. Have you read Untamed?
Yes, of course I have. So I mean, I kind of, like, every month I reread You Can Heal Your Life by Louise Hay, which is, it's a bit mad. I'm reading at the moment a really lovely book called The List of Suspicious Things by Jenny Godwin, which is set in the sort of late 70s during one of the Yorkshire Ripper was on, and it's sort of loosely based on her childhood, of this kind of childhood that was overshadowed by the knowledge of this man who was out that they didn't know, you know, they didn't know who it was killing women. And it's about two girls of 12 who decide they're going to find out who the Yorkshire Ripper is.
That sounds brilliant.
It's so good.
Okay, I'm going to add that to my list. And your final love for us is skincare, which is definitely a love that I share.
Yeah. Okay. So this is, like, a bit, given I've got on, you know, like, just be happy being you and all that stuff. So for me, this is like a real, like, a sobriety thing, because I used to collapse into bed with, like, all my makeup on, never wash my face. You know, it was like not knowing where I was, or, you know. And so for me, there's something sort of, there's a lovely ritual to, like, I don't think it makes me look any different, and I don't really care how it makes me look, but it's a kind of more an action of, like, putting this, you know, going through it and getting into bed, and I feel safe.
Talk me through the routine. So is it a nighttime thing? Do you put, like, a little headband on? What's, like, the different kind of stages that you go
cleanse,
through?
A double cleanse with a flannel. And then, oh my God, I've got an LED mask.
I have one of those. They're so fun.
They're so good.
You look nuts.
You look nuts in them, but I don't care. But I also find them really relaxing.
Yeah, yeah.
So I'll put that on for, like, 20 minutes, read, and then... I'll put on, like, a plumping serum, and then it's, you know, some retinol. It's nothing too complex. I have a Space NK at the bottom of my road, and they do know me in there. They're like, hi, Bryony. They bring out all the things.
Oh my God. I think I know the Space NK.
I love Space. Like, yeah. I literally spend hours in Space NK. I love it. It's just so, like, I find it really inclusive. It's like like, they're all just really nice in there. And they've got, you know, and it's kind of like, it's brilliant.
It makes sense, though, because I think, like you said, like, if you spend so many years not taking care of yourself in any sense, but particularly not taking care of your skin, I suppose, when you're in the grips of addiction, it can be such a soothing... I hate saying self-care, because I think that phrase has been so co-opted by TikTok and social media, but it is a really kind of reassuring thing to do, to kind of just look after your skin.
Yeah.
And just have that ritual every day.
It's more like, I don't often wear makeup. I am wearing lots of makeup right now because I've done some television this morning, and obviously because I was coming on your podcast. But I for me, it's not about vanity, about protecting myself. So, like, in the morning, that's a more important skincare routine. Again, wash my face and put on it's putting on SPF, because it's like, I don't know, like, forming a protective barrier and saying, you know, you're worthy of taking care, you know, it's worth taking care of you and looking after you, and, you know, protecting our skin from the sun, because, you know, I don't want to get skin cancer. And, you know, it's, I don't know, there's something sort of like, it's a kind of little way in which I say, I'm going to look after myself today instead of trying to sabotage myself, which is kind of my instinct when I wake up in the morning, is how can I, you know, it's like, how can I get out of everything I have to do today? Like, because I'm awful and I want to hide under this duvet. And so it's a little way of sort of counteracting that.
I love that. That's such a lovely note to end on. Thank you so much, Bryony.
Thank you for having me. I've loved this.
Thank you so much for joining us. That's it for today. Thank you so much for joining us. If you've enjoyed this episode of Love Lives, you can listen to all episodes on all major podcast platforms, and you can also watch us on Independent TV and all social media platforms. I will see you next time. Bye.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.